My daddy's grave is back there, and I just have to hope other people are putting flowers on it. I miss my dog. I miss my students. I feel really guilty because I'm still hung up on all this stuff that we left behind. I should just let that go. But it makes me so angry that these people have taken our lives from us. Then Anne smiled again, as though she couldn't really help herself. You can't grieve all the time when you've got your kids. You see how far they've come, and they reach you right in your heart. That moment when they come off the bus is one of my best moments. My other is when they get up in the morning, and they collide on top of me. So regret? No. I miss the things that were in the old life. But if I knew this was going to happen, I would still adopt Kelly. I'm the lucky one, because honestly, if it weren't for Kelly coming into my life, I would never have entered this bigger, more beautiful world, where I've met you and so many other wonderful people. I would still be married to a man for the next 20 years. I mean, if you just look at it, Kelly has brought more blessings into my life than I could possibly give back to her. In 1990, Judith Butler published Gender Trouble, a book that rocked the idea of the gender binary. In 1999, in a new introduction, she wrote, "One might wonder what use opening up possibilities finally is. But no one who has understood what it is to live in the social world as what is impossible, illegible, unrealizable, unreal, and illegitimate is likely to pose that question." 2 decades after the book's publication, those possibilities are open wider even than Butler hoped. When a friend of mine, a professor at a Midwestern university, was pregnant with my goddaughter, one of her students volunteered that she was planning to name her first child Avery, because "I just thought Avery is a nice ungendered name that my kid could keep if he or she ended up a different gender from the one he or she got born as." Norman Spack described similar conversations, calling them a new era of no variant person left behind. Playfulness about gender is much more commonplace than it used to be. To some extent, transgenderism has become a fad, Meyer Balberg said. This observation conformed with my experience. I met people on college campuses who were defining themselves as genderqueer to express revolutionary feelings or to communicate their individuality. They were gender fluid without being gender dysphoric. This phenomenon may be culturally significant, but it has only a little bit in common with the people who feel they can have no authentic self in their birth gender. Michelangelo explained that one of her 10-year-old clients says, "I know I'm a boy, but I don't want boy toys. I don't want boy clothes except to go to school. Most of his friends are girls." Angelo asked, "What do you imagine for yourself as an adult?" He said, "I'll probably be a dad who sometimes likes to be a girl and sometimes likes to be a boy." Angelo explained, "That's drastically different from the 9-year-old male-bodied kid who comes in and says, 'I want to be a mommy when I grow up.'" Such children imagine themselves past convention. The imagining would once have been questioned. Now, it is often the convention that is being reassessed. Belonging is one of the things that makes life bearable, and it can be tough to look at a binary world and choose against both sides. A therapist who works with children with various challenges told me that it's much harder to be ambidextrous than it is to be left-handed. Sometimes, idiosyncrasy can be a pose, membership in the smaller club of the anti-club. But often, it is a marooned consciousness that occurs not because genderqueer is a cool thing to be, but because neither the duality nor the spectrum fits. Such experiences express the wide vision that lies outside of belonging. When I met Bridget McCourt in 2009, her son, Matt, was 7 and a half and had been dressing as a girl for 3 years. He had long, beautiful blonde hair and a distinctly boyish manner. When Bridget first agreed to buy him some dresses at Goodwill, she thought they would be just for dress-up, but that was not what Matt had in mind. A few weeks later, it was time to pick out fall clothes. "I let him decide what clothes he wanted," Bridget said. "He went to the girls' department and was consistent about wanting girl clothes. I just thought, we'll take this day by day. He pretty clearly says that he is a boy. He's comfortable with his body, but he likes girl things. He's irked by the labeling. I have told him, 'Matt, if I were told I couldn't wear pants, that would feel so limiting to me. So I can understand that you would feel the same way about dresses.'" Someone who doesn't conform to the stereotypes of his gender, but who identifies with it nonetheless, has no clear path. When I met Matt, he looked like a long-haired boy in a dress. Older trans people who don't appear to inhabit their gender look sad. Whenever I saw someone who looked like a middle-aged man in a dress, I felt an ache. In a child, the effect was curiously transfixing, as though he had just imagined himself into being. For a long while, it was important to him for people to know he was a boy, Bridget said. At the park, he would come over to me with a kid and say, "Mom, tell them." He now realizes that it's just easier to let someone who meets him for 5 minutes refer to him as she. I wondered if Bridget feared for his physical safety. "I worry more about his losing the confidence to be himself," she said. "It would pain me to see him fold inward." An almost constant tension exists between the accommodations a trans child will make to the norms of the world and the accommodations the world will make to the norms of a trans child. When Nicole Osman took her daughter, Annika, to see Santa Claus at a local mall, she was worried that Santa would either look at Annika and call her a boy, which would be upsetting, or would look at her name and promise her girlish toys, which would be even worse. She tried to explain the possible problem to Annika, but Annika said, "Santa knows who I am, and Santa knows what I like." Nicole saw Christmas falling apart. Then she spotted an elf who was keeping the crowd amused while they waited. She took him aside and asked him to get the message to the big guy. Annika was a girl, and she wanted boy-type toys. Nicole asked me wryly, "Has anyone else you've interviewed had to bribe the elf?" At 4, Annika said she wanted a short haircut. Nicole suggested a bob, but Annika wanted a crew cut like her father's. People started mistaking her for a boy. Nicole worried that this would upset Annika, but Nicole's correcting people was what upset Annika. At school, Annika was marginalized by the girls because she wanted to play with trucks and was into soccer, and by the boys because she was a girl. Her father, Ben, was worried. "Since nobody would play with her, I'd show up with a soccer ball at recess, and we would start a game," he said. "One by one, people would join the game. I would slowly pull out, and pretty soon everyone wanted to play with her." Nicole said, "I told her, 'I don't shave my legs, I don't wear makeup, I'm not this princess girl. There's some really amazing cool girls that are athletic and they like soccer. Then there's a few girls who feel like there's just been a really, really big mistake, that they really should have been born a boy.'" There was this long pause, and I was totally expecting her to say, "Well, I'm one of those cool girls." She said, I think there's been a big mistake. I met Annika when she was 12 and a half. Her presentation was masculine, but she regarded herself as female. Annika had discovered herself in ice hockey. "At hockey, I'm more masculine," she said. "But sometimes I do feel more of a girl at school, because the boys are weird. I want to pick things from each gender. Lately, I've been thinking about taking testosterone, but still playing hockey with girls and being a girl, but having the deeper voice. It's just a thought." Although Annika did not want to transition or live as a man, she also didn't want to develop breasts, and she was taking Lupron. "I'm very open to my friends that I'm taking a shot, and that's why I'm not going into puberty and all that." Nicole and Ben had always had somewhat unorthodox arrangements. Nicole worked full-time, while Ben stayed home with Annika and her little sister. "We've played with those roles a lot," Nicole said, "but the fluidity is challenging. Some days Annika goes in the girls' bathroom, some days in the boys' bathroom. That is still so outside the norm." Annika said, "Everyone's different, right? Other people's way of being different could be being able to skateboard across America, or being able to swim for half an hour without stopping. My thing is being different in a gender-fluid way. On the soccer field of life, I'm just not a goalie. I'm a midfielder. I'm me, and that's who I am." When Vicky and Chet Pearsall took their son out, people usually thought he was a girl. "His dad was an all-American soccer player and professional skier," said Vicky. "Hugh never liked balls. At 2, his favorite thing was to wear my red high heels, a towel on his head for hair, and anything he could drape as a sari. As Hugh grew up, Chet tried to set limits. He would tell Hugh that he couldn't go out dressed in girlish clothes, and when Hugh asked why not, Chet said, 'You've got a penis.' Hugh said, 'Well, let's get rid of that.' Chet was appalled." Vicky read that most children who want to change gender don't like themselves. "Not Hugh. Hugh thought he was the cat's meow," she said. Vicky and Chet joined a monthly support group. "You'd have a father break down and cry, and tell the story of ripping the Barbie doll out of his son's hand, tearing the head off. Everybody came into this group and thought they had this really unique experience with their child, and it was so textbook. The kids did the same exact things." Vicky's concern was how to prevent her child from being traumatized. "I would always ask the trans people who came in to speak to us, 'What did you want to hear from your mom and dad?' They'd start sobbing. I was amazed by the cruelty." When Hugh was 8, he began to be conscious of other people's take on him. "He started to edit his behavior a lot more," Vicky said. "He's been a happy kid, but there have been times where he has felt really alone, particularly from 4th to 6th grade. At 10, Hugh set up shop as a jeweler, working with semi-precious stones, and quickly found an online market for his creations. Within 2 years, he had started a business designing handbags as well. "Since about 12, he's been very conscious of the signals he's sending," Vicky said. "It's not 'bring it on,' but it's 'I know what I'm doing.' My husband was concerned about his getting beaten up. We enrolled him in Taekwondo classes when he was 10, and this May, he's going to have his black belt." When Hugh was applying to switch schools in 9th grade, before each interview he'd discuss with his mother which bag he should take for his papers. It could be a bag that looked like a briefcase, or it could be something wild. Before one interview, he chose a pink Prada document bag. He was admitted to the school. By the time I met Vicky, Hugh was 14 and almost 6 feet tall. and he was still being mistaken for a girl. It was in his body language and the tilt of his head. Vicky found the idea of surgery upsetting, but would have supported him if he'd gone that way. But he had shown no interest in it. His parents' acceptance of his gender play had not pushed him into transition, any more than their playing ball with him would have turned him into a jock. When he was little, I just couldn't figure it out, Vicky said. All we really had to figure out was how to get to the point where we were no longer self-conscious about what who he is says about who we are. Emmy Werner, one of the founders of the field of positive psychology, has written a great deal about gender roles and their relationship to resilience, and has found that resilient children overcome traditional gender roles altogether. The males can be very assertive, but they're also willing to cry when crying is called for. The women can be very nurturant, but they're also very independent and autonomous. Rearing children in very traditional sex roles may not be very helpful when it comes to meeting life's emergencies. In the world of gender, what was progressive 2 years ago is conservative today. Brill cites as an example a mother in Oakland who filed a complaint alleging that the school's embracing policy toward transgender students didn't specifically address the concerns of gender-fluid children. Some trans people are disturbed by this evolution. Renee Richards, who fought for the right to play professional women's tennis after transitioning in the 1970s, said, "God didn't put us on this earth to have gender diversity. I don't like the kids that are experimenting." And then, "I didn't want to be a trans in the middle of something, a third sex or something that's crazy and freakish and not real." Richards's certainty that God did intend people to be trans the way she is trans, but not the way some other people want to be trans, suggests an intimacy with the Creator that strains credulity. In 2011, the performer Justin Vivian Bond spoke of transitioning without surgery. "I like my penis, and I am keeping it, but I am creating a trans body. A physical record on my body, and a medical record that I am a transgender person. I am turned on by people who are genuinely themselves. It's not nature versus nurture. It's nurturing your nature." When he was still Emma, Eli Rude didn't hate her female body, and she didn't feel that she'd have to kill herself if she couldn't gain access to hormones and surgery. Emma had a good life as a butch lesbian. When she became a man, he was not particularly masculine. Eli has both male and female virtues, and altering his body did not enormously change them. Eli Rude seemed to have transitioned simply because it felt logical. Despite a mental health diagnosis of GID, he had taken his gender change as an occasion for clarity. Emma and her fraternal twin, Kate, grew up in Portland, Oregon. Their mother, Joanna, had become pregnant during a casual relationship and kept her babies. Emma came out as a lesbian. She had a fondness for neckties. She kept a crew cut. She bound her breasts moderately, but not tightly, and at 5'7" was read as male about half the time. She started college at 15. Joanna said, "I knew she was looking for her tribe, but I missed her. It was harder in some ways to have a child who was so gifted than to have a child who was gender nonconformist." At her college graduation, Emma came out to her mother and sister as trans. Reviewing it when we were all talking together, Joanna said, "It seemed like it hurt you, the process of thinking, maybe I'm kind of a freak. You were a great lesbian. You were good at it. You were very sad about this, and it was very scary." Eli recalled, "I kept wondering, am I really trans? there was this classic narrative of people who have felt miserable, miserable, miserable. And I wasn't. Finally, my therapist said, you don't have to be totally miserable to pursue options to make yourself happier. In the summer of 2005, age 20, Eli moved to New York and asked people to use his new name and pronouns. He found a job at the Columbia School of Social Work Library, presenting as male. By April 2006, he wanted top surgery. His mother offered to pay half the costs, refinancing her car to do it. Eli grew a beard, as most trans men do to establish their gender beyond discussion. There have been some testosterone-related emotional and mental changes, but it's hard to gauge what's totally endocrinology and what's psychosomatic, he said. I've lost some patience, and I get frustrated more easily. I have more trouble focusing, and my verbal fluency has declined. It took transitioning to realize how much I didn't like my body before. Transition is really a second adolescence. I feel very fortunate in coming at it right on the tail of my first one. I don't regret that first puberty. It contributed to the richness of my experience. He thought for a minute. If I'd lived earlier, if it had been much, much harder to even think about transitioning, I might not have done it. I didn't choose to have the desire to change, but I did choose to act on it. People make a decision to have chemotherapy or not. People make a decision to take antidepressants or not. That doesn't mean that they're not sick with cancer or dangerously sad. Eli went to the New York City civil court for what should have been a straightforward name change. His request was denied by a judge who said he didn't want to adjudicate gender. Legally, name changes can be denied only to those who are attempting to evade creditors or who want to dissociate themselves from a criminal record. People come in all the time and change their name to Bunny Superstar, Eli said. I was changing mine from Emma to Elliot. The judge wanted medical proof that Eli was changing his sex. He could have supplied it, but was outraged to be asked. The ACLU took the case, and the judge changed the name to Elliot. Eli's father, absent when he was growing up, always related better to men, and in Eli's view, prefers having a son to a daughter. He feels qualified to ladle out fatherly advice to a son, like, don't go out and get anyone pregnant, Eli said. He actually said that. He was kidding, but it's still kind of weird. Joanna said, my parents didn't help me much. I educated myself. I was lucky that somehow I had the strength to make myself, and I'm lucky to have produced a child who had the strength to make himself. Eli has struggled with whether to identify as trans or simply as male. Some people say, I'm a man with a transsexual history. That's a nice turn of phrase. I'm with a woman I've been with for 2 years. She has dated men and women in the past. There are elements of our relationship that she calls lesbianic, and she says she feels very lucky to have a boyfriend who's familiar with the lesbian landscape. Both of us feel strongly that we're not straight, so we don't have a straight relationship, even though I'm a guy and she's a girl. Later, Eli wrote, I don't feel like my gender has changed much. I'm the same slightly effete, masculine person I've been for ages. The only regret for all of them has been Eli's loss of fertility. Joanna took the seahorse as a family symbol because the male seahorse holds his developing offspring in a brood pouch and then gives birth after a labor that can last several days. Kate wrote, Eli is soon to be rendered infertile by the very treatment that has made possible his visions of himself as a father. So we wait for the day when science might make a seahorse of him. infertility may be the steepest price of transition. Many trans people I met spoke of the longing to have children, but trans men mostly disliked the idea of carrying a pregnancy, and trans women mostly mourned their inability to do so. They wanted to be fertile in their affirmed gender, and our science is a long way from making that possible. This issue, as much as any other, defined the limitations of transition. Early in his transition, Eli wrote on a blog, "I felt sometimes that the guy who is me, this guy Eli, is out there somewhere, waiting for me to find him, waiting for me to figure out how to become myself. I worry because everything feels unsteady, and I don't know where to look for the guideposts, and I worry that I'll never find him." But someone really important to me once said, "It's okay. You're strong. And Eli, he'll find you." The International Olympic Committee, IOC, has long required that athletes be screened for gender. The original method was a physical examination, then measurements of hormone levels, then a scan of chromosomes. The reasoning behind such testing is clear. If men and women did not compete separately in athletics, almost all the champions would be men, because testosterone strengthens the body. But the testing itself has been fraught with contradictions and problems. In 2009, the South African runner Caster Semenya was subjected to gender testing after she won gold in the women's 800-meter race of the International Association of Athletics Federation, IAAF, World Championships. IAAF suggested she might have a rare medical condition that provided an unfair advantage. Tests revealed that Semenya had internal testes instead of a uterus and ovaries, and a testosterone level 3 times that of an average genetic female. In the wake of the controversy, the IOC said that women with hyperandrogenism might be disqualified from events. But the idea of a normal level of androgens for women is a fiction. Individual levels vary widely. The IOC requires that any irregularities be reviewed by a panel of experts, who decide case by case and in strict confidence. Even before this recent controversy, Arne Lundqvist, chairman of the IOC Medical Commission, said, "There is no scientifically sound lab-based technique that can differentiate between man and woman." Of her humiliating ordeal, Semenya said, "God made me the way I am, and I accept myself." As a human rights advocate, Shannon Minter spends most of his time in court avoiding ontological questions and focusing on the human stories of the people he represents. In Cantoris v. Cantoris, Minter argued on behalf of a trans man who was divorcing his wife. The wife was challenging his legal parenthood by attacking his legitimacy as a man, and therefore by extension their marriage. Florida does not allow same-sex marriage or adoption. When the case was broadcast on Court TV, Michael Cantoris, who had lived a fully assimilated life, was brutally exposed. An elderly, heterosexual, Republican-appointed judge was called out of retirement to hear the case. Minter called his client's parents as witnesses and saw the judge's thinking changing day by day. Michael's mom said, "It is so painful to me to hear anybody refer to Michael, even in the past, as she," Minter recalled. "Here's this woman that the judge could totally relate to, so he never did it again." The judge eventually wrote, "Transsexualism is a massively complex and difficult problem deserving of the highest respect and sympathy. Being further denied by the courts of the basic fundamental right to marry violates their constitutional rights and degrades them as human beings. Minter believes that the unifying challenge for gender activists is to create a society in which gender is disestablished as a legal concept. Everything short of that is going to entail significant incoherence, he said. There is no sensible, much less scientifically valid way to classify people based on race. The Supreme Court has recognized that. We don't put race on birth certificates. Race is no longer a legally relevant category except as a self-identification. That must also happen with gender. Minter added that this shouldn't be confused with the somewhat dated feminist ideal of abolishing gender. People are very attached to their own gender. I certainly am. It's much more like religion. It would be shocking to think that the government could define somebody's religion. It needs to be just as shocking that the government could define someone's gender. Minter's determination comes out of personal history. A man in his 50s who has an extraordinary record of accomplishment and a wide circle of friends, he said, "A week before my father died, he introduced me for the first time to someone as his son, and it meant more to me than anything else that ever happened to me." In looking at disability, I ran up repeatedly against Peter Singer's eugenic idea that not all human beings are persons. In trans studies, the progressive idea that not all males have male bodies. Though Singer and the trans advocates appear to be at opposite ends of the spectrum, at some level they present the same argument, that changing social mores and advancing science have caused us to question the basic structuring principles of human society. Genesis describes a world born in categories. God made grasses and trees, then whales and fish, then fowl and birds, then cattle and creeping things and beasts, then human beings to have dominion over all the rest. Male and female he created them, says the verse. In the great creation story, humans and animals occupy categories that can never cross, as do men and women. In the 21st century, new arguments are afloat, that some human beings are not persons, that some persons are not human beings, that some men are women, that some women are men, that some human beings are persons but are neither women nor men. Globalization has blurred national identity, and intermarriage has compromised racial identity. We like categories and clubs as much as we ever have. It's only that the ones we thought were inviolable turn out not to be, and others that we never imagined are taking their place. When Carol and Lauren McCarrow met, she was runner-up for Miss Texas, and he was completing his training in ophthalmology outside Fort Worth. When they married, he took her home to Helena, Montana. They adopted their son Mark because they thought they were unable to conceive. However, Carol became pregnant with Paul, later Kim, about the time they brought Mark home. Carol gave birth to another son, Todd, a couple of years later. Mark had behavioral problems. Whenever school called, Carol recalled, it was an award ceremony, academic or athletic, for Paul, or to tell me Mark had been suspended. While all the anxiety was focused around Mark, Paul was secretly struggling with gender. "I had a paper route when I was 10, Kim remembered. "It was very early. I used to cross-dress because I didn't think anyone would see me. Then I would throw away the clothes and pray that some power could dispel this thing that was making me unlike anyone else I knew of." Paul became a great athlete and was quarterback on his high school football team. "That was the recipe to be normal and a way to shut off your brain," Kim said. "If you're uncomfortable with your body, you want to control that body, and sports are a really good way to do it. Paul was valedictorian and class president at Helena High, where he was voted most likely to succeed. I knew the word manqué, as in artiste manqué, Kim said. That was my word, because it just meant, oh, if only you knew. Paul went on to Berkeley and spent his junior year, 1988, abroad. Everybody else is going to Florence or Paris, Kim said. I'm going to Norway, because I'm just going to hide in a long, dark winter, read Beckett, drink blackberry tea, and starve. I went thinking, I'm going to stop this. A couple months into it, it was like, I can't stop this. Some people give a single date for their transition. Kim describes hers as happening from 1989 to 1996. She moved to San Francisco and saw old friends and family as little as possible. The only person from her previous life who knew was her brother Todd, who was openly gay. He was easygoing and had come out without much drama, but she kept even him at arm's length. Kim was the most generic name she could think of, and she changed her last name to Reed, her old middle name, to make a fresh start. Even so, Kim felt awkward and artificial. It took 5 years for her to start hormones. I wasn't sure who I was, Kim said. I wasn't even sure gender was the gateway. It's awfully complicated, awfully expensive, awfully isolating, and the practical angle alone is very difficult. Today, however, Kim has an unaffected femininity. Once when I was out with her, someone came up to her and said, "My friend is struggling with transitioning. You're so relaxed. How did you learn all these gestures?" Kim said, "When I was making the switch, I was too conscious of how I moved, and it wasn't until I began to forget about it that who I really was started to take over." In the winter of 1995, Carol's younger sister, Nan, was diagnosed with colon cancer. When Kim, still Paul to the family, would call her aunt, she would talk to her mother too, but for almost 5 years they didn't see each other. When Nan died, however, Carol expected Paul to attend the funeral. Kim, who had been on hormones for over a year, was a pallbearer, with only a ponytail to attract comment. Carol said, "It was a funeral, but he looked so sad, and I still had no clue." A month later, Paul called and said, "Did you ever wonder, as I was growing up, whether I was comfortable with my own sexual identity?" I said, "I thought you were the golden child." He said, "Well, I've been dressing as a woman." Carol was bewildered. I felt very sad for all that anguish he'd been going through that I didn't even suspect, she said. Kim sent her mother a stack of medical information. "I didn't need to read any pamphlets," Carol said. "For me it was, I love my child. The intelligent, caring, humorous person is still there. All I wanted to know was, are you happy now? Are you comfortable?" But she worried about telling Lauren. Kim once said, "When I transitioned, I felt like I had climbed out of a wetsuit I had been wearing my entire life. Imagine that magnificent rush, the tactile sensations as though your body had just woken up. But I also felt like this new person couldn't go home, and I began to dismantle all my connections to Montana. At the time, I didn't know how thoroughly all of this saddened me, and to compensate for that, I started to turn my hometown into a place that I didn't really need to go back to." That exile continued even after Lauren had been told the news. No one else in the family was to know. Mark had been in a car accident and suffered a traumatic brain injury which led to even more erratic behavior than he'd previously exhibited, and Kim was afraid of his response. I felt like I owed it to Mark to tell him, but I thought he would hurt me, and I felt too vulnerable, Kim said. Carol said, Mark is saying, am I ever going to hear from Paul again? And it was getting worse and worse. But Kim said, when Mark knows, all of Montana knows, and I'm just not ready for it yet. Kim was right, because Mark wanted something on Paul. Mark wanted to say, well, at least I'm more normal than you turned out to be. Lauren had contracted hepatitis in medical school. While Kim was growing into herself, his condition was worsening. He was on a waiting list for a liver transplant, but at 62, he was not given priority. In the summer of 2003, he decided to visit each of his children. Kim had moved to New York, told her parents that she was a lesbian, and started seeing a woman named Claire Jones. Carol and Lauren had dinner with Kim and Claire the night they arrived. I started feeling better about everything, Carol said. I loved Claire the minute I met her. I was so worried Kim was going to be alone. Claire walked around the corner, and I just breathed a sigh of relief. Several months later, Lauren collapsed and was taken on an emergency flight for treatment in Denver. Kim flew immediately to join her parents. She arrived at the hospital a few hours before her father died, while her brothers were still arranging transport to Colorado. Kim reached Mark on the phone as he was boarding his flight and said, I've been out of touch. I didn't know how to handle it, but now because of Dad's death, we're all going to be together, and you need to know about me. At the Denver airport, Kim gave Mark her card and said, Here are my phone numbers. You can call me any time. At that point, Carol burst into tears, not about Lauren, but because Kim and Mark were speaking again. There they all were, displaced in a strange city, bereft of the reason that had brought them there, but also more united than they'd been in years. Later that day, Carol, Kim, Mark, and Todd set out for Montana by car. During the long trip, Kim reaffirmed her connection to Mark and tried to answer his many questions. He was bewildered, but not unkind. Whenever there was cell phone reception across the plains of Wyoming, Kim made calls to uncles, aunts, and cousins. My father has died, Kim recalled. They're reeling. They're hearing the news about me. And they respond with, We're just glad to have you back. Carol decided to host a tea party for friends in Helena who could help get the word out about Kim, so she wouldn't need to discuss the matter at the funeral. My mom, God bless her, just owned it, Kim said. People couldn't really throw a fit because everyone had the emotional meat tenderizer of my dad's passing forcing them into kindness. Kim was at the airport picking up Claire when the tea party took place. Carol had invited 19 women and the male pastor from her church. She explained Kim's transition in brief, then said, I'm not responsible for my child and who she's become, but I am responsible to her, and she is a wonderful person. I love her. I don't know if you need to know anything else, but that's all I need to know. After a moment of silence as the guests absorbed this information, somebody said, Amen. Then Carol said, I'm telling you this now, and I'm not going to speak about it again the rest of the weekend. I'm concentrating on Lauren's service and celebrating his life. When I asked Carol why she hadn't encountered the kind of community hatred that I had seen so many other families battle, she said, I think it's because of how we had lived our lives up until then. Kim added, My dad wouldn't grab the bull by the horns like my mom did. A tea party was the last thing he would do. But he would somehow cause things to be such that a tea party would happen. He would delight in the fact that his little nudge had caused everything to fall into place. Sue O'Leary was one of the guests at the tea party. Her son Tim O'Leary, who had been Paul's closest friend, was in town for the funeral. "There's a viewing of my father's body at the funeral home, and all of my friends who have heard the news are there," Kim said. "I've said I'm not going because I want to keep it about my dad, but I'm really chickening out." Before I know it, Tim and all these guys I knew in high school, essentially the football team, open our front door, and they've got cases of beer under their arms, and Frank Mayo's saying, "Yeah, I had this dream that we were all fat, bald, and old, and you were a girl." It was the living room I grew up in, and Claire's sitting on the couch, knocking back cheap beer, and there's a couple more cases outside in a snowbank to keep them cold. This guy has his arm around Claire, and they're laughing, and I was just like, this is going to work out just fine. The next day was the funeral. Carol recalled, "I'm not a Bible student at all, but there is one verse everybody knows, John 3:16, and it says, 'God so loved the world that whosoever believeth in him shall not perish and have everlasting life.' I just really caught onto that 'whosoever,' and I held onto it that day of the funeral. When people said, 'I see Mark, I see Todd, but I don't see Paul,' I referred them to the friends who had come to my tea party." As Kim and Claire traveled home from Helena a few days later, Kim decided to make a documentary that would begin with her 20th high school reunion that fall. Mark had been held back a grade in elementary school, so they graduated in the same class, and both planned to attend. Prodigal Sons charts Kim's departure from her geographic community to her identity community. Mark's deterioration and the enormous stress it placed on the family, and Kim's complicated, ambivalent love for her brother. The film is full of the childhood Kim shared with Mark and Todd, including footage shot by her father when she was still Paul, the quarterback. At the film's start, Mark's head injury has fossilized his sense of the past, so that he looks only behind, while Kim's transition has meant that she looks only ahead. As her changing identity and his unchanging identity collide, she enshrines the very history she long wished to abrogate. When Kim appeared on Oprah with her mother to promote the film, Oprah played a clip in which Mark accused his mother of trampling the Bible by welcoming Kim. Oprah said, "Well, do you believe in the Bible?" Carol said, "I believe in my child." 6 months after I met her, Kim called me one night excitedly with an invitation. The pastor from her church in Helena was organizing a Prodigal Sons weekend, a screening on Friday night, seminars on Saturday to discuss issues raised by the film, and a sermon by Kim on Sunday, all, coincidentally, the weekend of Carol's birthday. I traveled to Montana a few days early. A year earlier, Carol had invited 26 people to her house to see the film. "I worried about some of those people, so I told their spouses that I was concerned," she explained. "Since I'd done that, they all felt very proud of saying at the end of the evening, 'See? Everything is fine, Carol. You needn't have worried.'" One of those people was an old friend who had recently lost his wife, and at the end of the screening he seemed disturbed. Carol asked if he was okay, and he said he was not. "My heart sank," Carol told me. Then he told me that he had just had no idea that it was so serious with Mark, and how much I had been shouldering. Carol and Don bonded through the conversation, and when I went out to Helena, they had become a couple. 2 years later, they invited me to their wedding. At breakfast on the morning of Carol's birthday, I found her furious and mournful. She handed me the Helena Independent Record, where a banner headline across the front page blared, "Helena Prodigal Son Returning as Woman," and below, "Former QB at HHS to present film telling story of sex change." Kim was at a festival in Iceland and wouldn't be arriving until the following day. When Carol and I went to the church to decorate for the festivities, the pastor said she had been in touch with the police to arrange safeguards in case of rioting or attacks. Carol threw up her hands. The film was going to come here sooner or later, and I didn't want it to just get booked into our local movie house, the Myrna Loy, and have no control over it, she said. This is the way it should come, at my church, where there is love. But those headlines cheapen it. It is stressful to be stripped bare in front of a small town where you've lived your whole adulthood. Carol is not a show-off, or a lonely person, or a born activist, so she didn't need to tell her story for the reasons that motivate many people. She said, "I know people who have had to look at accounts of their sons being arrested for child pornography or embezzlement, and Kim has not hurt anyone. In fact, she has helped many people." Nonetheless, she was visibly shaken. The night of the screening, Plymouth Congregational was packed with a long waiting list for tickets. I sat next to Carol in the back row, and she cried through much of the film and had to leave the sanctuary twice. When the film ended, Kim stood at the front of the church, and the audience began to applaud. A few people stood up, then a few more, and then it became a standing ovation. When it ended, Kim invited her mother up. Carol had composed her face into a smile by then, and as she walked briskly down the aisle, everyone stood up again. And when Carol arrived at the altar, she and Kim stood with their arms around each other's shoulders while the audience continued cheering. Carol's bravado had transformed the screening into an occasion of triumph. Now Kim was the one crying. At the reception afterward, I told one of the church ladies that Kim had worried about the conversation the film would provoke. And the lady said, "Our hardest conversations aren't with other people. They're with ourselves." Once she had settled who she was in herself, we were ready to have whatever conversations we needed to make sure she knew this was always home. On Sunday, the pastor commented that she had never seen more congregants except at Christmas and Easter. The entire McCarrow clan was there. Some had had to drive many hours from their farms. The service opened, "We pray today for your blessings on those who are abused for being who they are, and for those who are abusers." Hymns were sung. The parable of the prodigal son was read. Then Kim came forward. "Although the parable is usually interpreted as a story about the father," she said, "it is also a story about a son who receives a welcome he would never have dared to expect." She said, "The night before last, when our film was playing in here, I went outside to the columbarium where my father's ashes rest. As I was kneeling there by what I call Dad's spot, I thought of the hours and hours of videotape that he shot lovingly of me during my football games, and how much of the same footage was now being shown inside this sanctuary. Now, it's certainly not the context that any of us expected, but I knew Dad would be proud. And just then, the dusk breeze blew in this waft of sound, and it was strangely familiar to me, and I realized it was the crosstown football game coming from the stadium. The band was playing, and the announcer was bellowing, and all of these old tapes were playing inside here on the screen, and I knew that new ones were being recorded just a few blocks away. Those recording their new memories to tape should be only so lucky as to be surprised by the last thing that they expected from their loved ones. Only so fortunate as to get a chance to welcome them home with radical love. I thought about how all these cycles of lives would continue on, and so many aspects of my life coalesced in that one moment, that one beautiful, stunning, blessed moment, the past and the present, parent and child, male and female, the pain that life sometimes brings, and the soothing love that welcomes it with open arms after its exhausting journey into a distant country. That afternoon, after the service, Carol and I went for a long walk. I said, "Do you wish that Paul had just been happy to be Paul and had stayed that way?" Carol said, "Well, of course I do. It would have been easier for Paul and for the rest of us. But the key phrase in there is, happy to be Paul. He wasn't, and I am just so glad that he had the courage to do something about it. No, if he had been happy to be Paul, anybody would wish for that. But since he wasn't, I can't imagine the courage that it took. I had somebody say this weekend, 'Carol, Paul died, and I haven't finished mourning that.' I don't feel that. Kim is much more present to people than Paul ever was. Paul was never rude. He just wasn't totally present. We didn't quite have his attention." She laughed, then said with adoring emphasis, "And look what we got! Kim!" And Grace seemed to be both the cause and the consequence of her happiness in that emphatic declaration. As I worked on this chapter, I kept returning in my mind to Tennyson's beautiful tribute to Arthur Henry Hallam, in which he wrote, "And manhood fused with female grace, in such a sort the child would twine a trustful hand unasked in thine, and find his comfort in thy face." Our received notions of masculinity and femininity are a modern conceit. Though Hallam was neither trans nor gay, his magnetism inhered in this blending of strength and gentleness, boldness and compassion. I remember first reading Tennyson's lines when I was a teenager, thinking that he celebrated this friend for the very qualities that most troubled me in myself. I wanted to be something noble, not just a boy who had failed at real masculinity and was making do. I wanted to emulate what was best in my father and mother, in the life of the mind to which men often stake first claim, and that of the heart in which women usually have the upper hand. I saw in Tennyson's bracing words an encomium not to an androgynous face, but to the intricate nature of beauty. Masculinity and femininity here seemed not locked in binary competition, but fused in collaboration. Anyone with an open heart should know that the world would have ended long ago without the translators who convey male and female meaning across gender's fierce boundaries. It may be a recent phenomenon for that to be an identity, but what has changed is the characterization of such people, not their eternal merit, nor their uncanny, necessary splendor. I have a great life as a man, and have made it all work, but I know that at 12 I'd have chosen to be a woman if it had been an easy and complete transformation. Perhaps that is only because being a woman looked more respectable to me than being a gay man, and 12 is a conformist age. I don't regret not being a woman, any more than I regret not being a tough and easy football hero, or not being born into the British royal family. Trans children usually believe they are already members of a different gender, and I never did. Being gay has worked out happily for me in the end, and since one lives in a continuous present, I don't feel the afflictions I have resolved as permanent losses. Though my last book was, after all, about depression, my path has had its challenges. Yet I like to imagine a